welcome tonight. Thank you so much for coming to tonight's event, celebrating the launch of Haymarket's and Carrie Leiderson's new book, Mayor 1%. We are very grateful to the Haymarket Brewery for having us tonight. Obviously, they hold a special place in our heart at Haymarket. At Haymarket, we like to say that we are publishing books for changing the world. But books themselves don't change the world. People do. And the people Carrie describes in Mayor 1%, the people organizing for change and for justice, are the ones changing the world for the better. When we started talking to Carrie about this book, we knew she was a terrific writer and journalist, but we're thrilled with how vividly she's brought to life one of the most destructive political figures in our city's history, as well as the truly inspiring resistance to the agenda of the 1%. In this age of austerity, budget cuts, segregation, mass incarceration, and school closings, when put next to the vast wealth of the very rich friends of our mayor, documenting the struggles of those who stand up are critically important. After our panel speaks, we invite you to buy a book at the back of the room, bring your book to Carrie to sign. We hope that it's a sign of the resonance of the book's message that the book's first printing has actually now sold out. And it hasn't even been out for 2 weeks yet. So forgive us if we run out tonight. We will send you a copy that's signed by Carrie. Please also take a moment to mute your NSA listening device if you have one. And please join me in welcoming Carrie Leiderson.
Well, thanks so much to Haymarket for inviting me to do this project, and they've been so wonderful to work with. And thanks to Haymarket Brewery for having us here, and to the panelists for joining me, and everyone for coming. It's exciting to see just this much interest and this kind of resistance bubbling up. So I'll read a little bit from the book, from the introduction, and then I'll introduce the panel, and we'll all talk, and then we'll have some time for questions and comments. So this is the introduction starting March 4th, 2012, about a little over a year after Rahm Emanuel was elected mayor. So March 4th, 2012 was Chicago's 175th birthday, and the city celebrated with a public party at the Chicago History Museum. The event promised actors portraying famous Chicagoans, including Jane Addams, founder of Hull House, an advocate for immigrants, children, and factory workers. Little did the organizers know that the show would be stolen by a woman some viewed as a modern-day Jane Addams, more eccentric and irascible, less renowned and accomplished, but just as willing to raise her voice and speak up for the weak and vulnerable. Mayor Rahm Emanuel grins broadly as the Chicago Children's Choir, dressed in red, sang a lively version of Happy Birthday. He had reason to smile. 10 months earlier, he'd been inaugurated as leader of the nation's third most populous city, taking the reins from legendary Mayor Richard M. Daley. And while his term hadn't been a cakewalk, so far things seemed to be going well. He had inherited a nearly $700 million budget deficit and attacked it with an aggressive round of cost-cutting and layoffs. The labor unions had resisted, but ultimately Emanuel was able to strike some deals and come out on top. Meanwhile, he was moving forward with his plans to institute a longer school day, a promise that had gained him positive attention nationwide. He was already assuming Daley's mantle as the Green Mayor. In February, he had announced that the city's two coal-fired power plants would close, and miles of new bike lanes were in the works. Emanuel had even snagged two important international gatherings for Chicago, the NATO and G8 summits, to be held concurrently in May 2012, the first time both would be hosted in the same U.S. city. There had been sit-ins and protests by community groups and unions related to the summits, to the school closings, and other issues, but Emanuel had shown a knack for avoiding and ignoring them, and so far he didn't seem to have suffered too much political fallout. As Emanuel watched the swaying, clapping singers at the birthday party, he didn't seem to notice a crinkled orange paper banner bobbing in the crowd of revelers. It said, "History will judge Mayor 1% Emanuel for closing mental health clinics." He'd gotten the moniker early on in his tenure. As Occupy Wall Street-inspired protests swept the nation, it was a natural fit for a mayor known for his high finance connections and brief but highly lucrative career as an investment banker. A staffer for the mayor or the museum did notice the banner and told the man holding it to put it away. Matt Ginsburg Jekyll complied, partially folding the banner and lowering it into the crowd. The song ended, and Emmanuel began shaking hands with the singers and other well-wishers near a colorful, multi-tiered birthday cake. Then a shrill, rough voice cut through the chatter, causing heads to turn as the orange banner was unfurled and raised again. Mayor, I'm sorry, I wish I could do the voice of Helen Morley, which is burned into many people's memories, but I'm sorry, I'm not going to try. Mayor Emanuel, please don't close our clinics. We're going to die. There's nowhere else to go. Mayor Emanuel, please, cried a woman with a soft, pale face, red hair peeking out from a floral headscarf, and dark circles under her wide eyes that gave her an almost girlish, vulnerable expression. It was Helen Morley, a Chicago woman who had struggled all her life with mental illness, but still managed to become a vocal advocate for herself and others in the public housing project where she lived, and for other Chicagoans suffering from disabilities and mental illness. For the past 15 years, she'd been a regular at the city's mental health clinic in the Beverly Morgan Park neighborhood, a heavily Irish and African American working and middle class area on the city's southwest side. It was one of six mental health clinics that Emanuel planned to close as part of sweeping cuts in his inaugural budget. He said it made perfect economic sense. It would save $3 million and the patients could move to the remaining six public clinics. But Morley and others pleaded that he didn't understand the role these specific clinics played in their lives and the difficulty they would have traveling to other locations. Morley's eyes were fixed unblinkingly on the mayor as she walked quickly toward him, calling out in that ragged, pleading voice, her gait and gaze intense and focused. Almost all eyes were on her, except for those of the mayor, who shook a few more hands and then pivoted quickly and disappeared through a door, studiously ignoring Morley the entire time. Mayor Emanuel, she cried again as he dashed out, please stay here, Mayor Emanuel. The abruptness of the exit, the cake sitting there untouched, the lack of closing niceties, and the crowd milling around awkwardly gave the impression that the event had been cut much shorter than planned. With the mayor gone, Matt Ginsburg Jekyll and fellow activist J.R. Fleming stepped up on the stage and lifted the banner behind the cake. Morley centered herself in front of them and turned to face the remaining crowd, earnestly entreating, people are dying. They aren't going to have nowhere to go. Emanuel's critics and admirers have both described him as a quintessential creature of Washington and Wall Street, a brilliant strategist and fundraiser who knows just the right way to leverage his famously abrasive personality to get wealthy donors to open their wallets and to help him win races. He became a prominent fundraiser for powerful politicians in his 20s. He made some $18 million in investment banking in just 2 years. He played central roles in two White Houses, and he orchestrated a dramatic Democratic takeover of the House of Representatives during his 6 years in Congress. He clearly knows how politicking works, but being mayor is different, or at least it should be. In Washington, people are often tagged as political allies or adversaries, fair game for manipulation or intimidation. In Congress, Emanuel represented his constituents, but the daily grind had a lot more to do with beltway machinations and maneuvers. Running a city where you are elected to directly serve people and listen to them is supposed to be a different story. But Emanuel was treating Chicago as if it were Washington. Perhaps that's why, even in his brief tenure as mayor, he has seemed to find it so easy to ignore the parents, teachers, pastors, students, patients, and others who have carried out multiple sit-ins and protests outside his fifth-floor office in City Hall. These citizens frequently note that Daley had not been particularly accessible, sympathetic, or democratic in his approach, but at least he would meet with people, acknowledge them, make perhaps token efforts to listen to their proposals and act on their concerns. Emanuel can't seem to find the time for many members of the public, they complain, even as he says he wants their input on issues like school closings. Parents, grandparents, and students with the Kenwood Oakland Community Organization, for example, camped out in City Hall for nearly 4 days trying to deliver a formal plan that community members had drafted in conjunction with university experts to protect their local school from closing and create a network of educational resources in the surrounding low-income neighborhoods. His response was to ignore us, said G2 Brown, COCO's education organizer. We had our problems with Mayor Daley, but Daley surrounded himself with neighborhood people, and he himself was a neighborhood person. This man, Rahm Emanuel, has surrounded himself with corporate people. The administration is doing the bidding of the corporations and robbing us of the things our parents fought for. So that's to set up the battle lines a little bit. So now I want to introduce the panelists who've been kind of at the forefront of, Mayor Emanuel, but of the struggles that have really taken center stage since he took office. So Brandon Johnson is a teacher and organizer with and community activist with the Chicago Teachers Union. Amisha Patel is with the Grassroots Collaborative, which launched the Take Back Chicago movement about 2 months ago. And Ben Jarofsky is with the Chicago Reader, one of the mayor's probably favorite people from Chicago. So we'll hear first from Bryn.
Well, thank you, Carrie, for your intellect and bravery around this topic. And let me just say this, because the mayor of Chicago is always looking for opportunities to run commercials. And when Julie introduced the book, she said Mayor 1%, and you all applauded. So if you're in a commercial cheering for Rahm Emanuel, you did it here tonight. So just be careful next time you applaud when 1% mayor is introduced. So let me also just say, it's an honor to be a public school teacher. And the threat against public education is not a conspiracy. It's real. The attack on public education, we can find the attack on public education at the very inception of this country. And so I would be remiss if I did not at least acknowledge all of my brothers and sisters of the Chicago Teachers Union who are here tonight. And so thank you, brothers and sisters. Appreciate you. Because this fight for public education is collective. But let's just put some things into context. Mayor Emanuel represents all that is bad when it comes to public education and just privatization as a whole. And so if we think about the history of this country, where educating black people, poor people, was illegal, you fast forward through the Civil War, it was somewhat permitted, but they begin to burn down schools that attempted to educate black people and poor people. And then now you fast forward to 2013, they're now closing schools. 50 schools here in Chicago, where Mayor Emanuel actively pushed for that failed policy. School closings in Philadelphia. Kansas City has lost half of its public schools. The attack on public education is real, and it's being carried out by both Democrats and Republicans. This is a bipartisan decision to roll back everything that we've built in this country. And so when we think about what has happened here in Chicago, when the mayor, first of all, I think it's interesting that before Rahm Emanuel became the mayor of Chicago and there was some flirting of him running, the president of the United States said that he thought that Mayor Emanuel would make a great mayor. Little did we know that he was only speaking for the 1%. And I think that we have to be extremely critical of both political entities that are dead set on destroying public education. And when you look at the narrative around this country and you see Republican governors, Democratic mayors that are all committed to the interests of private corporations that want to shape education in their image. Let's also be very clear that these are the same corporate interest groups that have found their foothold here in Chicago that are also looking to turn a profit off of public education. Here in Chicago, the budget for public schools is $6 billion. It's a lot of money that the corporate interest groups want to make sure that they have their hands on. And so we have to be very clear. Just like we've introduced here in Chicago what a fight could look like around the country, that the group that says that they are in favor of our children, that they want to provide choice and opportunity for our parents, they're not telling the truth. they're being extremely disingenuous. And today, through the leadership of Carrie, we're going to expose that. And so, if we could just try to rush through the strike, which I think is quite unfair, because it was the most exciting time that I've ever had as a teacher. 4 going our paychecks to ensure that children in Chicago receive a quality of education is something that not only teachers can be proud of, but parents can be proud of, because it was one of the most important and popular strike that we've ever seen in our country, and we can thank Rahm Emanuel for that. And so one of the things that we were very clear about, we weren't just simply fighting to fend off those that wish to destroy public schools. We actually had a plan that works. And one of the things that we made very clear during the strike, that you cannot separate public education from the conversation of poverty, because poverty in this country actually matters. And so when we begin to do a diagnostic test, if you will, on the public schools here in Chicago, we discover that over 160 schools in Chicago did not have public libraries. Just going to let that sink in for the rest of the world, that children were going to school every single day without access to a library or a librarian, where class sizes were out of control, 35, 40 kids in a classroom, or even worse, some students did not have a regular assigned teacher to their classroom. No proper ventilation, no air conditioning, no books for our students. This is the city that launched the first black president, but we can't get books for students? There's something terribly wrong with the country that will pride itself as this great inclusive situation that will deny poor people the opportunity to learn. And so as the CTU began to expose the fact that the mayor was pushing a longer day, even though he was not going to fund it, the mayor began to push for a longer day, even though there was no evidence that a longer day was going to result into better learning outcomes. Not only did we expose the fact that we didn't have libraries, no books, no proper ventilation, no air conditioning, class sizes were out of control, where most of our students did not have art and music. We're talking about very basic fundamentals for our children to be able to learn and to flourish. This mayor was dead set on moving failed policy that did not deal with the big issue, which was poverty. And so when the CTU made the conscious decision to forego our paychecks, to ensure that at least the conversation is raised, it's a day or days that we'll never forget. But where are we now? So even after the strike, and there were some positive wins that we took away from that strike, we're also very clear that after the strike, the mayor of Chicago was determined to destroy the CTU. And so what did he do? He moved an agenda to not only close down schools, but to close the largest number of schools in our nation's history. And so thousands of parents organized, marched for days, connected with community leaders, connected with their pastors, connected with their school leaders, to say with a resounding voice that we do not want our schools closed. Because research tells us that closing schools does more to harm our students than actually help them. And so after thousands of parents came out from all over the city to say we don't want our schools closed, the mayor stood at a press conference and said, this is what parents want. His gross neglect and his arrogance has caused tremendous turmoil in this city. Think about what the first day of school looked like here in Chicago. We're talking 50 years from the March on Washington, and our children were escorted to schools with police officers, helicopters, firefighters. This looked like something straight out of Alabama. This is the city of Chicago. This is America. And poor children are being forced to walk through territories that are not only not safe, but once they got to the schools, all the things that the mayor promised, he did not deliver. And then he took it one step further, where school budgets have been drastically reduced, where in some cases 9, 10, 15 teachers have lost their job because of this mayor's policy to defund public education. And one of the other big elephants in the room, and I'll close with this, is that you cannot have a conversation about public education without having a conversation about race. And the schools that were closed were overwhelmingly in black and brown communities. And we're seeing this across the country. But in Chicago, it's actually mind-blowing because this is quite personal. I'm raising two boys in Chicago. Yes, they both happen to be black as well. Very attractive young boys, by the way. But my oldest son, who is now in kindergarten, so I'm a CPS parent, a proud one, by the way. But our neighborhood school was closed. No one asked me whether or not my school should be closed. And so now my sons and the kids that he's growing up with do not have access to a public neighborhood school. Not only did the school closings overwhelmingly affect black children, but it also affected black teachers. Over half of the teachers that lost their job were black. And we've seen this gradual decline that was actually implemented or started 20 years ago when the mayor of Chicago, Mayor Daley at that time, took complete control of the public school system. And then he had this ingenious idea to put Paul Vallis in charge of the public school system. And if you look at Paul Vallis's record, Paul Vallis is actually the grandfather of privatization and corporate takeover of public schools. And so Paul Vallis has gone to Chicago, where public schools have been destroyed, New Orleans, public schools have been destroyed, Philadelphia, public schools have been destroyed. You get the point. And finally, when he got to Connecticut, those folks up there said, oh, we know what you're about. And they sent him packing, but they sent him back to Illinois. So we got to figure out somewhere else for him to go. But The move of the mayor to continue to privatize public schools, to close these schools while at the same time calling for more charters, is something that's not only going to exacerbate the loss and the decline of black teachers, but it continues to stratify our school systems, where you have intensely poor black children in a concentrated school with very limited resources, and the very people who black children tend to look towards for some sort of guidance and hope, that group is being denied. And so my last point here is that as Chicago, with the first black president sitting in the White House, the policies that are being moved by Arne Duncan are destructive. W.E.B. Du Bois said it this way, that public education at the expense of the state in the South in particular, after all, is a black idea. We cannot allow the black idea that moved this country forward be destroyed while the first black president sits in the White House. Thank you.
So I'm going to talk on some of the things that Brandon touched on, and also I think probably maybe a few things that Ben will touch on. So my name is Amisha Patel. I'm with Grassroots Collaborative. We're a community labor coalition made up of 12 organizations that work in the city and across the state around economic and racial justice. You know, I think Emmanuel, like many big city mayors, though, thanks to New York City, not all big city mayors, are pushing a fiscally conservative, pro-corporate agenda that benefits a few at the expense of many. I think Carrie does a really, really important job of laying out all the ways that that's true of Mayor Emanuel. What that's looked like here, as Brandon touched on, was a massive attack on teachers and the public sector. And let's be clear, that is about union busting. And that's about union busting in particular because of the power, the political power in particular, that unions have in the city, right? So breaking the union, closing down public schools, breaks the Chicago Teachers Union, which breaks the political power of Chicago teachers to fight back against his agenda. So there's a very clear thing happening here, so on multiple levels of what this attack looks like. He's also under, since he's been in office, has eliminated the head tax, the corporate head tax. So this is this was a tax that was in place on corporations with more than 50 employees to basically pay for some of the infrastructure expenses of and to acknowledge the profits that corporations were making by being based in Chicago. That was eliminated. So now, at the same time, that happened at the same time that he passed the budget to cut mental health clinics by 50%, right? So a very clear connection of who's benefiting and who isn't from the policies that moved forward under this administration. He's also continued, I mean, this, of course, didn't start with our current mayor, right? We had a few years of Mayor Daley beforehand where a lot of this agenda was moved forward. But he's absolutely continued the pro-downtown development, and in particular around what TIFs, tax increment financing, has done and what that looks like here in the city. So I think Ben actually called it this himself, which is that it's a shadow budget, right? So it's about $500 million every single year that gets diverted from our property taxes that instead of going to schools, parks, and libraries, at this point, goes a huge majority of that money goes towards downtown development, towards developers in the central part of the city, goes to things like DePaul University's basketball stadium. Again, at the same time, within weeks of the historic destruction of 50 public schools in the Black community was the announcement, I think originally around $50 million, I think it's up to like $90 million now in TIF money that's being used on this private university stadium. And that's just one example of several different things that have come, you know, that have come under, in terms of TIFs even, there's many different projects of that. One of the things that the collaborative actually spent a bunch of time fighting against was $29.5 million to River Point Plaza. So River Point Plaza is a downtown building that's soon to be constructed. And that $29.5 million of TIF money was used to create a park. But what they call a park and green space is actually some trees for smokers, no offense to smokers, on their smoke break to have a pretty place to look at while they're, while they're working in their corporate high-rise. Meanwhile, you have Brighton Park Neighborhood Council that has been fighting to rehab Kelly Park that has only needed a couple million dollars to make that a safe park space. And for this Latino low-income community, the city consistently saying there's no money. There's no money. They find money, though, when they need to, and they found $30 million pretty quickly to give to wealthy developers who have plenty of money to construct that building in the first place. There's a pretty high vacancy rate right now in downtown Chicago, so what happens is when a downtown building gets created with TIF money, it just means that you're moving tenants from one building to another. You're subsidizing the profits of that new development, but not actually creating any new resources, right, to go back into the community. Privatization under this mayor, again, continues a long line of privatization here in the city. A few things that our Mayor Daley had done that we continue to live with. Mayor Emanuel moves along those same lines, right? So looking at privatization of airports, of healthcare with the closing of the mental health clinics, waste management, this idea of forced competition between public employees and privatizers, infrastructure, the Chicago Infrastructure Trust that is still completely really unknown, though when introduced originally was introduced in a mad hurry. Our infrastructure is crumbling. We have to pass this now. There is no time for debate. And a year later, they are just now introducing the first projects. But it was we had 3 weeks or 4 weeks within to try to mount any fight back against this effort that is really really potentially dangerous in terms of the amount of power given to private financiers whose interest is not the public good when it comes to infrastructure, but it is about their profit. That's a very dangerous precedent, and we weren't able to put any kind of real accountability or checks against that power because, again, it was told to us that it's, bridges are falling down right now, and it will be on your head if that bridge falls and you've stopped us to try to actually put some accountability in. And all of this, right, is under this theme of a global city, right? The Mayor Emanuel really trying to create Chicago, again, under this name of a global city, which is code word for basically a city for white folks with money. It really is about policies that perpetuate a city that is a divided city, right? One of two cities where those who can benefit do benefit through their connections and through their political positions are doing quite well in the city. But when you step outside of those lines, right, which is about where we are now and a few mile radius from where we're sitting today, the city looks really different. And the struggles are really different. And the benefits that are supposed to trickle down to us, and we've heard this before, continue to not be true. Our work to really take this on, and I think that, has been about trying to organize against this, to lift up the truth around what's happening. Folks get it. Like, we've door knocked in the last few weeks around TIFs, around the surplus ordinance. We've been door knocking in neighborhoods across the city. People get it immediately, right? This is actually fairly much a no-brainer. It's also very clear is that folks are looking for independent leadership. They're looking for their aldermen in particular to be independent leaders, to actually stand up against the mayor, to fight for what's happening in the neighborhoods and communities. Yet there's a disconnect between what the council actually does and between what residents in the city actually want. One of the things that Brandon talked about that is, I think, incredibly important is looking at race when we talk about the city, race and racism and the policies in the city. Grassroots Collaborative a few weeks ago released a study called Downtown Prosperity, Neighborhood Neglect, and it looked at the impact of jobs in the city. And what we looked at, what we noticed was that the mayor would every day, sometimes, or every week, or sometimes every day, would announce, make a new press conference, a new press release about all the jobs that he's bringing in successfully into the city. So we knew there's this one story that mainly mainstream media was eating up quite easily, and sort of like that long list. I don't know what it got up to, 30, 40, 50,000. And meanwhile, the reality of the closing of public services in the city, we knew that who was losing jobs in that moment, which wasn't being counted, there were no press conferences that the mayor announced around that, was a loss of primarily Black and Latino workers in the public sector. So, which is the place where you have middle class jobs in communities of color. So the destruction of mental health clinics, the destruction of schools, the cutbacks to libraries, all not only has a direct effect on communities because of those services not being there, or those institutions not being there, but also people's livelihoods being destroyed, that years and years and decades of work and the place to get good jobs being completely destroyed. So we knew that there was a disconnect in terms of what was really happening. So we did a study that looked at job growth and job creation. And what we found is that within a 10-year period, in the last 10 years, over 50,000 jobs were brought into were created in Chicago. And we looked closer at that number, and what we found is that 3 out of 4 of those jobs went to folks who live in the suburbs, who live out of state. These jobs are heavily subsidized, again, by tax increment financing, by Chicago tax dollars that actually are not going to create jobs that Chicagoans are getting. And we looked at the 1 in 4 jobs that were going to Chicago residents, and we did an analysis based on zip codes, because, of course, in Chicago, in such a segregated city, we can find out who's actually getting those jobs. And surprise, surprise, those jobs are going to the areas of white majority zip codes in the city. Black majority and Latino majority zip codes have lost huge numbers of jobs downtown. So when we look at actually what the policies are and who's benefiting from it, it's very clear what's happening. And instead of reducing inequity in the city, the policies of this administration are actually furthering the divide. So all that to say, what do we do? Or what we actually like to talk about is WWHD, which is what would Harold do? And part of the reality of living here in Chicago is that we have to look 30 years ago to look at the last time there was a political moment and a movement happening in the city. And I think as organizers now, part of what we're trying to think about is what can we learn from that movement 30 years ago, and what does it take at this moment to actually move forward a new vision for the city, or what we call taking back Chicago. What this looks like for us, or what we're experimenting with right now, is, and I don't think it's rocket science, but it is about organizing, it's about strategy, and having a framework that's very clear and political in terms of how we understand what the issues are and what we're going to do about them. So I think it's really clear that the streets are alive. The streets are absolutely still alive. It was such an amazing inspiration to be a supporter of the Chicago teachers during the strike, and to really have such a clear perspective of whose city this really is. right? And though the strike is over, that city is still ours, and our work is to organize to make that actually true, and to have people reconnect to that fact, and to actually be taking action to build a movement. Part of what Take Back Chicago did, so on October 15th, we pulled 2,000 people together at UIC Forum under a shared economic justice agenda. And we looked at five different campaigns, and we looked at five campaigns that were actually already moving that people were working on. So a campaign to raise the minimum wage here in Chicago, a campaign to have a fair tax so that the rich pay their fair share in the state of Illinois, a campaign to, a campaign to make sure that our tax dollars actually go to education and not to these not to downtown developers. We had a push around the budget and to make sure that there were not cuts to public services, and certainly no more cuts to mental health clinics. Though I think the real push is to get restore and expand that those services back, instead of always being on a let's fight to make sure we don't a defensive fight. How do we actually expand public services in this moment, which I think is really key to moving families in the city forward. And I think that part of what this effort was trying to do was how could we actually create a political moment, so we're not waiting for 3 months before an election to try to pull people together, or 3 months after an election to say, okay, what are we going to do? How do we actually try to create a political moment? Because we know that the dissatisfaction and the anger is there. And how, as organizers, can we create a space for people to come together and express that dissatisfaction and that anger in a way that connects into active campaigns? And what we did out of that Take Back Chicago is that citywide, we had over 30 organizations, 2,000 folks. We moved into a campaign to try to push forward the TIF surplus ordinance. Now, the TIF ordinance wasn't what we created. We actually did this work 2 years ago, what we called for back then was a responsible budget ordinance. But I think the key thing that's relevant there is that in that ordinance that we did 2 years ago, where we called for a TIF surplus and we had parameters about which TIF district, really targeting downtown TIF districts. 2 years later, Mayor Emanuel actually issues an executive order. Pretty much calling for what we called for 2 years ago, but it was now his idea. But our push was an executive order isn't good enough. Let's make legislation, and let's make sure that this can't be changed by the whims of the mayor about whether he decides that this is actually good policy or not. So I know I need to wrap up, but what I'll say is that in 4 weeks from Take Back Chicago, we put 676 calls into aldermen, patch through calls of voters into their aldermen, sent 993 emails, 738 postcards that we got from door knocking and from grassroots mobilization across the city. And all of this work in an intensive period of time led to three new votes into the in addition to the Progressive Caucus around this TIF surplus ordinance. And you could look at that and be like, my God, what a failure. And I think the reality of this political moment in the city is, my God, we got three votes. And clearly it's not enough, right? But this is the beginning, and that's why we're organizing now, and it's clear what it takes to actually get those votes. It was a huge amount of work by Bickerdijk, and I see Marla here in this room, who was a big part of that fight. It was a huge amount of work by folks targeting several aldermen across the city to hold their feet to the fire, and I think that's exactly what it takes. We've got to have real political education at the grassroots. We've got to interconnect our communities, so we've got labor and community and faith together organizing at the grassroots level. We've got to have a very clear narrative of where we're trying to go and not be afraid of naming this as the corporate agenda, because it's not actually something that folks in the communities are scared of. They get it. They're living it every day. And we've got to have coordinated strategic action to be bold, be clear, and be correct in our work. And the last thing I say is that we have to actually build grassroots political power. 2015 is not that long away. There's work to be doing. There's energy that's out there. We've got to actually mobilize, build a grassroots political base to take back the city, because it's ours. Thank you.
Well, first of all, my name is Ben Jarofsky, and I write for the Reader newspaper. Thank you. And I believe I am definitely the oldest person on this panel. So I have the longest amount of memories and experiences about Chicago. And so before I get too involved in memory lane, I want to thank Carrie for writing this book. I find nothing personal, but I find Mayor Rahm Emanuel one of the most annoying and obnoxious people that I've ever had to cover. So better Carrie than me in terms of dealing with him. I read it and wrote about it, so your book, that is. And I think you were remarkably restrained, very fair, and you really bent over backwards to try to give the man his due, even though he would not participate in the writing of the book, would not be interviewed. Even his assistants would not be interviewed, which sort of points out a point about Rahm, Chicago, and the people in this room. I presume that Rahm's handlers, or Rahm himself, took a look at Carrie's interview request when it came in and figured it was coming from the left, the perspective, that is. And as far as I could tell, Rahm Emanuel has utter disdain bordering on hatred for people from the left. I think that part of the reason he has that utter disdain is because, like many leaders of the Democratic Party, he works from the assumption that people on the left have nowhere else to go but to the Democratic Party. And so as a result, they're sort of a captive audience, and you could do to them what you will. Now, most Democratic politicians that I've followed don't turn that into disdain. So at least try to pretend like they care about the things that you care about. In fact, today I got a phone call from an alderman who will remain anonymous because this alderman wanted it to be an off-the-record conversation. I'll give away his gender. He was defending his vote in the recent TIF matter that Amisha was just describing, which was one of the most entertaining public debates we've had in the city in the last few years. And his point was that you have to work with the administration at times to get what you want, and you have to suspend your larger goals, beliefs, objectives, and principles from time to time to get ahead. This is a very, very common worldview in the city of Chicago. So I have, as I get older, have a harder and harder time being upset with the politicians that the people of the city of Chicago elect, and I become more and more upset with the people of the city of Chicago for electing those politicians. As much as I respect Amisha and agree with almost everything she says, I'm going to have to disagree with a couple points, or at least we could throw it out here as a possible point of discussion. When she said the people get it, I've seen, at the risk of sounding incredibly dispirited, no evidence that the people of Chicago have gotten anything since they elected Harold Washington back in 1983. And even that was a racially divided vote in which almost 50% of the city didn't get it. So I actually do believe with the second point you made, and this is part of this unique schizophrenic attitude in the makeup Chicago voters, which is that people in Chicago do respect politicians who stand up to power. I throw this challenge out to every single alderman I talk to, and I talk to aldermen all the time. I cannot recall any alderman who lost his or her seat because he or she defied an all-powerful mayor. For years, now, there's not a lot to choose from in that category, because, granted, but I go back. I remember there was an alderman from the South Side. His name was Alan Streeter, and he had a fight with Jane Byrne, and the people of, I believe it was the 17th Ward, elected him over Jane Byrne's candidate. I remember Helen Schiller, who one time or another was the leading independent in the city council before she learned about the TIF program and joined the ranks. But Mayor Daley tried every which way he could to unseat Helen Schiller. He threw up Michael Quigley at her. He brought in all his goons from the Southwest Side to run Quigley's campaign. And it was a divided vote, but Uptown reelected Helen Schiller. I stand by, I think Amisha's right, that people in Chicago, they may not get it, but they do want independence. Which leads me to this point. I still can't quite get my mind around the realization that the people of the city of Chicago not only elected Mayor Daley, what is it, five times in a row, but they overwhelmingly elected Rahm Emanuel. And so I go around, I ask more questions than I answer. I usually ask my fellow citizens, who did you vote for? Pretty much everybody I meet, I ask, who did you vote for? And now, based on the results of what they're telling me, I've come to the conclusion that Rahm Emanuel didn't win the election at all, and that the real winner was Miguel Del Valle. What it is, I think, is that a lot of people in Chicago didn't realize who they were voting for, or they didn't vote, which is just as bad. And so they elected this man who's a little to the right of Mitt Romney. And so now, what's next? And this is a question that is always being raised. I'm sure it'll be raised in this very room when the official program is over, as everybody says, well, who's going to run? And my response more and more has been that I think we should stop looking at the Harold Washington model, because that presumes a great leader will step forth to lead us out of the promised land. Now, Harold Washington was a one-in-a-lifetime individual. I see really nobody right out there now who reminds me of Harold Washington. So, in all his levels of greatness, he was an elected official, first of all, so he knew politics. So I always tell people to look at the Jane Byrne model. And the Jane Byrne model occurred 4 years before the Harold Washington model, which was in 1979. And in 1979, the voters of the city of Chicago got so disgusted with the way the city was being run that they elected a woman who had been written off as a complete and hopeless flake. She had no significant political support. She had no money to speak of. She was mocked and maligned by all the powers that be in the city of Chicago. And when that blizzard hit, and the machine was incapable of delivering the most basic and essential services, people just said, to hell with it. I'm voting for the lady. And she won. So I think Chicagoans, in my humble opinion, this is my dream, should stop being like children and looking for someone to lead them to where they want to go. And they should stand up and take accountability for their own city and elect somebody, well, even if they don't like the person, just defeat somebody that they really don't like. So we'll leave it at that.
Well, I want to say thanks again to Ben and Amisha and Brandon for talking and everyone for coming. And just to see a crowd like this is, you know, wanting to talk about the mayor and the victory of the teachers union is really amazing and inspiring. And that'll lead me into some points I want to make to wrap up, which is that this book is definitely a story about Rahm Emanuel. But it's also a story about Chicago and its people, and on both fronts, a really ongoing story. And I think talking about it, you know, despite Ben's very valid point about the fact that so many Chicagoans did vote for Rahm Emanuel and Mayor Daley over the years, nonetheless, we have a pretty amazing populace with just, you know, so much potential and talents and power. And I think it's really important to acknowledge that, especially at a moment like this, when I think there really is this sentiment with facts to back it up, including the study that Amisha talked about, that we're really at kind of a tipping point where Chicago's future and image and identity is being sort of redefined and reshaped. And the mayor has been really central to that. He's been really open and actually kind of boastful about the way he is transforming the city. And you hear all this talk about making it a hub of startups and tech companies and clean energy. I love clean energy. I write about energy. But, you know, a greener, cleaner, kind of hipper city that's really been drawing the creative class from all over the country. And, you know, all the bike lanes and the urban gardens and the, you know, the sustainable food hubs and all these things, which are great, but they're part of a new image for the city. And when Amisha mentioned all these announcements about creating the new jobs, and those have been, you know, there's been a lot of some studies, including theirs, that debunked how those numbers really add up in any way that benefits kind of regular people. A lot of these jobs are jobs that are already filled by someone in the suburbs who's just commuting into the city, or they may be new jobs, but they're looking for a very specific kind of person who's, you know, has these tech skills or very specific skills that sort of fit this new image. And they're not, in a lot of cases, jobs that can be filled by people that are without work, and including all the people that have lost their jobs because of the privatization and the cost cutting during this mayor's administration. And the teachers, the other staff at the schools, the janitors who work for SEIU Local 1, that was one of the stories that I was really inspired by following. They already worked for a private company, but for a contractor, but the mayor brought in a different contractor. It looked pretty clear so that he could bust the powerful SEIU Local 1 union, and the new contractor brought in workers that were making a much lower wage and much more part-time work, so far less sustainable jobs. The therapists at the mental health clinics, and the union says that all the black male therapists were laid off, which, you know, obviously has huge ramifications for their families and their communities, and also for the patients that had strong bonds and can't just go to another, you know, a white middle class woman therapist and have the same kind of relationship. So those people, you know, probably these people that were laid off are, you know, one of the janitors from O'Hare is probably not going to get a job at one of these new startups, you know, realistically, and that income is gone from their community and all the ripple effects that that has. I think, and that the way the mayor talks about reshaping the city and bringing all this talent in, he's literally ignoring all the homegrown talent and creativity and brilliance that we have here already. And specifically these, I think one of the examples that I alluded to in the introduction of the book was this sit-in that the Kenwood Oakland Community Organization did in City Hall. And they had developed a really comprehensive, seemingly really innovative, fantastic plan to save one of their neighborhood schools and to reinvigorate the surrounding community. And the mayor literally wouldn't even step out of his office to talk to them about the plan. They eventually got it into his hands, but there's no indication that he ever read it or responded to them about it. So he has a record of really ignoring input, not only ignoring, but actually actively sort of undermining and trying to discredit people like the teachers who are on the ground and have firsthand experience knowing how to address these problems, like the violence that's become a national, even international, really, embarrassment for the city. He may be talking to, you know, these different consultants all around the world about the most cutting-edge policing strategies, but he's not talking to the teachers and the parents who are impacted every day, and the kids. And that leads me into just one of my sort of one among many, I guess, of my pet peeves with the mayor. Talking about him ignoring public input, he canceled the budget hearings. Harold Washington had started these budget hearings in the evening, so in different communities, so people who work during the day and have trouble getting downtown could give their input about the budget. And the mayor did hold those hearings during his first fall in office, and he was booed at them because this was during the time period that he was making these draconian budget cuts and was already breaking or kind of ignoring union contracts that were in place. So he canceled the budget hearings for the next 2 years. And the Progressive Caucus did hold alternative budget hearings where people poured their hearts out, but the mayor wasn't there. There were literally several hundred hearings related to the school closings. And as far as I know, the mayor and his appointed school board members didn't show up at any of those hearings. And teachers, parents, community members, students were testifying at those hearings and pouring their hearts out and talking about what worked in the schools and what didn't. I mean, you really couldn't get a better forum for concrete input on, you know, how we could address some of the problems in the schools. So that, getting to the pet peeve I mentioned, during his campaign for mayor and then also during the time around the teachers' strike, which really kind of bizarrely became like a second campaign because the mayor had really picked this fight with the teachers' union from early on around the longer school day and denying raises that were actually in the contract. So The teacher's strike and the period around it became for him, and then the teachers were sort of forced to treat it this way as well, a battle where, you know, someone was going to win and someone was going to lose. So it was more about not actually, for the mayor, not actually reaching a solution, but beating the teachers. And, you know, their rhetoric was very clear, and it tapped into, of course, the larger debate around the role and the shape of public education and the role of teachers' unions. And the mayor and his proxies were really trying to drive home this message that, you know, the teachers are lazy and ineffective and greedy, and they're the ones screwing the kids over. So around this time, he had this phrase that he used several times in with a slightly different wording about the kids in the public schools having empty eyes or having nothing in their eyes, and, you know, this implication that they were so beaten down and, you know, their schools are so terrible that it was robbing them of their personalities and they just had no hope. And I mean, to me, and especially as a journalist who, you know, you try to look at the meaning of words and think, like, very literally, what do these words mean? It was just so ridiculous and insulting, and to me really revealed how he, you know, despite this being this sort of campaign mentality where he was politically obligated to make it seem like he cared about kids in the, you know, we're talking mostly like the South and West Side, lower income neighborhoods where all these schools were closed and where so many of the teachers and public school parents are, who are out on the streets, came from. So, you know, the fact, I feel like any parent or teacher or, you know, anyone who has a kid in these neighborhoods would not describe their eyes as being empty. I mean, they're full of life and full of hope and sometimes anger or sadness, and they, you know, they do experience a lot of trauma. But I just felt that, you know, that phrase revealed the mayor's not only lack of understanding but lack of respect for these whole communities. I know it's really cliche to say that youth are our future, but it's obviously true. So I think it is kind of striking that, you know, the mayor, it looks fairly certain maybe that he will have at least one more term, and who knows beyond that. So you are talking, you know, literally a generation of public school students who are growing up with this administration and seeing firsthand the debate over the role of the public sector and the way their parents and teachers are, you know, really being disrespected, and then also the way their parents and teachers and neighbors and themselves are going out in the streets and going to City Hall and going to the Board of Ed and becoming involved in this civic debate. So, you know, that's got to make a difference, and I think it'll be really exciting to see what unfolds over these coming years and what kind of legacy will last even after the Mayor Emanuel has either been voted out of office or, you know, left to try to seek greener pastures on his own. I ended the book with just kind of bringing it back to one of the other members of the mental health movement. I'm not sure if he's here, but Chuy Campuzano is, you know, one of the many mental health movement members who was really inspiring to me. And at all the different events and protests, and then people may have seen the videos or seen in person Ashawn Johnson, one of the young students who's become a real outspoken activist and who some people are saying should run for mayor. I don't know if Emanuel will still be around when he's old enough to legally do it, but just hearing about Chuy being really inspired by Ashawn, and he was saying Ashawn was at least his mom was, you know, telling him to sort of get some lessons from Chuy. So, I mean, there obviously are. It's just, despite the apathy and, you know, various things that Ben referenced on the more cynical side. I think it will be, no offense, we need that, but I think it will be pretty exciting and interesting just to see how Chicago responds. And I'll leave it at that. And thank you again to Ben and Brandon and Anisha and to Haymarket for Haymarket Books and Haymarket Brewery, and please tip well for the servers here at Haymarket. And then to open the some questions and comments, I wanted to actually start, if she's here, with Sarah Jane Ree, who was really generous in allowing us to use some of her photos and who is at the Woodlawn Clinic occupation. Is Sarah here? I don't know. No? Yeah. Well, anyway, so thanks, Sarah, and I guess, if people want to, raise your hands or, I guess. And I think we'll actually take about 4 or 5 questions, and then we'll kind of, open it up here a little bit. Sure.
Just trying to get behind you, Bill.
Yeah, pick the mic up.